Welcome to another broadcast of Studying the Scriptures. I'm your host, Dr. Todd Baker, director of Berit Hadashah Ministries in Dallas, Texas. Well, today we continue our study of the Feast of Purim. The Feast of Purim. And we are going to basically give you an overview of the events that are chronicled in the book of Esther to show you how the origins of Purim arose. And to do that, we must familiarize the audience with the setting of the book of Esther, the historical setting. It largely takes place in the spacious and luxuriant palace of King Xerxes. Now, in the book of Esther, he is called Ahasuerus. I believe that's the pronunciation. And the events unfold in the king's palace and in the gate of the city of Shushan, where Mordechai adjudicated as one of the king's officials. The events of Esther took place during the nadir of the Persian Empire. These things occurred at the greatest height of the Persian Empire's imperial glory. Indeed, we are told in Esther 1:1 that the boundaries of the Persian Empire stretched from India to Ethiopia, almost as far as the boundaries for Alexander the Great's empire, which stretched from Greece to India. And the Persian Empire would probably be second on the list after Alexander as far as having the largest territory and land acquisitions. When we open the book of Esther in chapter 1, we're confronted with a recalcitrant wife, one of the many that King Ahasuerus had. The scriptures tells us that Ahasuerus had a 6-day feast with his officials and the nobility of the kingdom. These officials came from the different provinces where they were satraps for Ahasuerus or Xerxes. And so all these officials were summoned by the king for a great imperial and royal party. We are told in the scriptures that this party, or should I say drunken revelry, went on for 7 days. And on the seventh and final day, while clearly inebriated, King Ahasuerus ordered his wife, Queen Vashti, to come and remove her veil from her face and exhibit the great beauty that she had. This was not the norm in the Persian Empire for women, because Persian law demanded that women do not unveil themselves in public to strangers, similar to the Sharia law of Islam today. Queen Vashti refused to accommodate the king, and by her disobedience set a dangerous precedent for the women of the Persian Empire to follow in her footsteps and not obey their husbands. This was the advice his princess gave to him after her refusal to come in and remove the veil. And so the only possible answer and solution for this was for the king to remove her from her position as queen and to find another more respectful and compliant to the king, according to Esther 1:19. And so Queen Vashti was deposed. In chapter 2 of Esther, We then see that Vashti's successor is sought by the king and his nobles. And these officers went throughout the provinces of the empire to recruit beautiful women who are then brought into the house of the women to be prepared as potential candidates for the king's selection of a queen to replace Vashti. And of course, among them was Esther. We are told that she immediately found favor with the keeper of the women, and I believe he was a eunuch for a good reason. Nevertheless, Esther found favor with this person. And so, with that, Esther was brought into the presence of the king, and immediately we are told, according to verse 17 of Esther 2, King Ahasuerus was captivated by Esther's beauty and her comportment. We are told that she found favor in his sight more than all the other virgins or potential candidates to be his queen. One of the recurring themes we already see in Esther is this sense of favor. Favor with prominent and influential men. And this, again, is a sign of the invisible providential hand of God orchestrating and arranging events to save his people or to carry out his will. And so this favor that was granted her, in the end, as you know, will be used to save her people, the Jewish people, from annihilation. And so the king made Esther queen of Persia. And then in conclusion of chapter 2, we have an incident where Mordecai, the cousin of Esther, learned of a furtive plot brewing and being planned by two rebellious chamberlains. They were plotting to assassinate King Ahasuerus. Mordecai quickly reported this to Queen Esther. She relayed it to the king. An investigation was conducted, and the evidence showed that this was true, and the conspirators were hanged as a result. The king, recognizing that Mordecai saved his life, recorded this noble deed among the royal chronicles of Persia, in the presence of the king. Chapter 3, we have the entrance of the evil anti-Semite Haman, the Agagite. He came into the king's palace because King Ahasuerus promoted Haman to be prime minister over all the other satraps or princes of the provinces of the Persian Empire. And this required that everyone bow and do obeisance to Haman. Mordecai was the only person, being a devout Jew, he refused to show this kind of obeisance because it was considered an act of idolatry, showing worship to a mere mortal, which Mordecai, being the Torah observant Jew that he was, refused to do this for fear of violating the law. The first commandment, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me. So in effect, bowing to Haman would be showing worship and honor that's due alone to God. Well, Haman was extremely offended by Mordecai's unwillingness to bow to him as everyone else was. And if he would not bow, Haman reasoned that since he was a Jew, his people, the rest of his people, the Jewish people, would also not bow before him. And in his insatiable megalomania, he was determined to have Mordechai then and his people destroyed, annihilated. And so he proposed casting lots to gain direction so that he could set a date on which to issue a royal decree for the destruction of the Jewish people. And when he cast the lot to determine the date for this extermination, the lot fell on the 12th month, which would be the month of Adar in the Jewish calendar. So this gave Haman at the time 11 months to carry out his insidious plan for the destruction of the Jewish people. Once he determined this, he sought King Ahasuerus. He sought to obtain his favor so that he could make his desire and decree royal law. He told Ahasuerus slanderously that there was a troublesome people that existed within the Persian kingdom. They were dispersed as a foreign and evil presence throughout the empire. They held incompatible laws that breeded treason against the king. Sound familiar? This is a pretext that anti-Semites throughout history have used to try to destroy and persecute the Jews. During the Roman Empire, it was the accusation that their monotheism, Jews' monotheism, was a desecration against the existence of the Roman and Greek gods and goddesses. Unfortunately, during the era of the papacy, Jews were accused of taking the Passover bread and mingling it with the blood of Christian children, and so forth and so on. So these slanders were used as an excuse to destroy the Jewish people. For Hitler, it was that the Jews were subhuman, and therefore they were a threat and danger to the superior German race. Getting back to our story, when Haman presented his case for the final solution against the Jewish people, he in effect bribed the king and his treasurers by offering 10,000 talents of silver so that this order could be approved by the king and swiftly executed for the time in which the date was determined by the lots. And so Haman, who acquired the king's favor, was now set to kill and destroy the Jewish people, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, Adar. And he was set to plunder, destroy, and kill them. And those who killed them would gain their possessions by plundering and looting their houses, their places of business, and so forth. And then in Esther's chapter 4 and 5, we read of Esther's life-saving intercession for the chosen people. When Esther heard about this through Mordecai, they were horrified. They were horrified at this news by the proposed murder of their own people by Haman, who abhorred the Jewish people because they would not worship him. This clearly shows us that Haman was operating by the spirit of Satan, who seeks to be worshipped as a rival and a replacement to the one true God, the God of Israel. And he seeks to be worshipped not just by anybody, but by the chosen people especially. Why? Because the Jewish people, Israel, are one people closest to God's heart throughout history because of the plan and destiny he has for them. And so Mordecai relays this plan for a final solution proposed by Haman to Esther, and he asks her to please intercede before the king on behalf of her people to save them from this decree of annihilation. And of course, this, if you will read, posed a great threat to the life of Esther, because Persian law said that no one could come uninvited into the king's presence. Whoever did that would be killed on the spot. They had to wait for the king to put forth his golden scepter or to request the presence of someone through one of his officials. And so Esther had not been called by the king for 30 days. And so if she went in there unannounced, she was putting her life on the line. Yet Mordecai earnestly pleaded in the face of that. He says to her, one of the most famous quotes in the book of Esther, he says to her, "If you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. Who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Esther realized that she had to make the attempt to save her people, and if that meant risking her life, then she was going to do it. At this, Mordecai gathered the Jewish community of Shushan, and they fasted for 3 days before she would go into the king, go into his presence unannounced. And so on the day, third day, that Esther determined to go into the king's presence unannounced and risk being killed by violating the king's law, she resolutely said, "So I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." And in this way, Esther is a type of Messiah, because the Messiah was willing to risk his life and did give his life for the salvation of his people Israel, and of course, to a larger extent, for the salvation of all mankind. Remember what Caiaphas said concerning Jesus. "Is it not expedient that one man die, than that the whole nation should perish?" Well, this was the same disposition that Esther possessed. She was willing to risk her life and even die if it meant the salvation and deliverance of her people from Haman's evil decree of annihilation. So on the third day, Esther went into the king's presence, dressed and made up. When the king saw her, he extended his golden scepter to spare her life. Seeing that she was greatly troubled, the king asked what he could do for her. And instead of coming right out and saying it, Esther put off her request and instead asked that the king and Haman come to a banquet prepared in their honor. At this banquet, the king then asked, "What is your petition? And it shall be granted you." Esther, probably sensing the time was not right, delayed the request again and invited the king and Haman to another banquet the following night. Haman, of course, misread the situation completely. He thought that he was going to be promoted in some fashion that would make him second only to the king. He went home and told his wife and his friends. And as he was going home elated at the prospect of such a promotion, again he passed by Mordecai, who again stubbornly refused to bow to him. Haman's hatred for Mordecai and his unwillingness to be an idolater to Haman then became uncontrollable. Haman told his family and friends, "Yet all this avails me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." His friends then said, "Well, once this decree is set, you can now construct a 75-foot gallows and hang Mordechai the next morning, since he, being a Jew, would fall under the decree of destruction that Haman contrived in his hatred for the chosen people. Then in chapter 6 of Esther, again we have the invisible providential hand of God guiding a pagan, polytheistic, worshiping king. The king could not sleep that very night. He could not sleep. And so King Ahasuerus called for his royal scribes and requested that they read to him his brilliant achievements and mighty exploits. And as the records, as the chronicles were read, Mordecai's faithfulness in foiling the conspiratorial attempt on the king's life was read. And Ahasuerus remembered that and realized, to his trouble and to his chagrin, that Mordecai had gone unrewarded for such a great deed in saving the king and his kingdom. So the next morning, the king noticed that Haman was waiting in the outer court to gain a meeting with him. Haman was waiting for permission to hang Mordecai upon the newly constructed gallows. And after that, the evil decree of Adar 13 would be carried out. The king allowed Haman to come into his presence. And the king asked Haman, "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" Haman then thought that the king was speaking about himself. And so he vaingloriously answered, "Let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a house on which the king, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which was a royal crest placed on its head. Then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him." The king then commanded Haman, here is the beautiful irony of it. The king then commanded Haman to quickly perform that honor to Mordecai, the one he despised because he wouldn't bow before him. And so Mordecai was robed, a royal crest was placed upon his head, and he was led in the streets on horseback by none other than Haman. And then in Esther 7, we have the plot, the evil plot of Haman, disclosed by Esther. At the second banquet, Esther finally expressed her petition to the king. She pled that King Ahasuerus would spare her and her people, the Jewish people, from annihilation. The king was surprised because at this point he was not aware that Esther was Jewish. The king was extremely upset, and he demanded to know the identity of the enemy. Pointing to Haman, Esther answered, "The adversary and the enemy is this wicked Haman." The king stormed from the banquet hall to contemplate what he was going to do next. And as he did so, Haman violently threw himself at the feet of Esther and pleaded for his life. And when the king came back in, he misperceived Haman's actions to be violently assaulting the queen. That was it. King Ahasuerus ordered the executioners to cover Haman's face and hang him on the very gallows Haman and his conspirators had prepared for the upright Mordecai. Another theme running through the book of Esther, upon which the Feast of Purim is based, is the idea of irony. Irony. And this is most true with the death of Haman in the place of Mordecai. The irony is quite biting, striking, and obvious. So then we come to the initiation of new decrees countermanding the decree for the destruction of the Jewish people. After Haman was killed, Mordecai assumed his position and was given the royal signet ring. The Persian law, which Haman drafted, calling for the destruction of Esther's people, the Jewish people, could not be rescinded, because according to the laws of the Persian king, once he issued a decree, it could never be repealed. However, it could be countermanded. And so the king then, therefore, in light of that, commanded Mordecai and Esther to draft a decree to the provinces, seal it with his signet, granting that the Jewish people had had a right to self-defense against their aggressors on the 13th day of Adar. When that terrible day came, Jews of Persia valiantly fought for their lives. And the rulers of the provinces, respecting the exalted authority of Mordecai, aided the Jewish people under their local authority. And since anti-Semitism was already festering and boiling over, fierce fighting began on the 13th day of Adar and carried to the next day, the 14th day. When the battle was finally completed, the enemies of God's people were killed. 75,000, we are told, was the total in all the provinces of the Persian Empire. 800 in Shushan, and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged on the gallows, lest there be blood revenge by them in the future. Then in Esther 9, verses 17 through 32, we have the institution of Purim and its first observance to remember this great deliverance that God wrought through Mordecai and Queen Esther. They sent letters, Mordecai particularly, sent letters to all the Jews in all the provinces of the Persian Empire. Near and far, we are told, that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar. The feast was called Purim, for Haman had cast Pur, that is, the lot, to destroy the Jews on the 13th day of Adar. Thus, Purim became a feast for Israel, a day of feasting and joy, of sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor, according to Esther 9:22. So the memory of Purim would always be remembered annually by the Jewish people, reminding them how God had saved them from total destruction and annihilation. Purim is a feast that reminds the Jewish people in the diaspora that even though they may not sense, feel, or see God's presence and providence working, His faithfulness to them, guaranteed by the unconditional covenants He made with them, guarantees that He will protect them from being completely annihilated. They will be preserved, protected, and those, in addition to that, those who seek their destruction will in the end be destroyed themselves. God protects Israel, and He protects you, fellow believer in Jesus. Those who would seek to destroy you, in the end, will be defeated and overcome, just as God overcame the enemies of the Jews, the person of Haman, and so forth. Well, I see we're out of time. Until next time, Shalom, Yeshua HaMashiach Aleichem. May the peace of Jesus, the Messiah, be with you.